Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop, our bookshop, and winner of the 2014 Best Bookshop in Philadelphia Award. And Amy, is our guest, has a bookshop, too, Eureka Books in Eureka, California. So today, we're happy to have with us our guest, Amy Stewart. Amy has, in the past, written mostly about our natural world, specifically and mostly botanically, about the flowers, herbs, fruit, and fungi that possess, in a sense, till we mess with them, our world, and contribute in so many wonderful ways, but sometimes destructively, to our lives, our pleasure, our pain, and our aesthetic of beauty. And she writes about worms and bugs, too. And just a few days ago, her recipes from the Drunken Botanist were sampled at Gardner's Nursery just down the street from us. And also her new book, the one we'll be talking about, is our selection for our book club in November, and hopefully she'll be able to Skype in. And it's a great book club book. So anyway, the previous books in her oeuvre, as previously mentioned, are From the Ground Up, The Story of the First Garden, The Earth Moved, On the Remarkable Achievements of Earthworms, Flowers Confidential, Wicked Plants and Wicked Bugs. That's two books, by the way. And now today, in quite a departure for her after that litany, she's here to discuss her latest work and her first novel, the acclaimed Girl Waits with Gun, which was published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, I guess now, on September 1st. This book, which is replete with an enormous amount of research, none of which shows, which is always good, tells the story of three real sisters, Constance, Norma, and Florette Kopp, who find themselves in a bit of a pickle when they cross the path of a ne'er-do-well silk dye manufacturer who is a real snidely whiplash of a character, well-drawn and completely hateful. Constance, 6-foot-tall Constance, is totally unflappable, is in no way daunted by this jackass, and proceeds to work her way to a solution to the mess that she kind of put her sisters and she into. And what is so cool to me in this book is the continuing undercurrent of humor that runs through it. It's not that Constance or Norma occasionally betray the hint of a smile, or that the beautiful Florette, who's either 14, 15, 16, or 17, constantly lives a life of humorous excess and flaunting. It's that the interplay between all three keeps you just on the edge of laughing and then throws you over the edge, even though the sisters are looking at you like you're nuts. So with a helpful sheriff and a backstory of a downtrodden and tragic figure of a lonely and woebegone girl, the book has depths that you aren't really aware of until you finish it, as I did in one sitting. Oh, and yeah, there's a deep, dark secret, too. So with that ponderous introduction, welcome, Amy, and thanks so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. I love that introduction. That was great.
Thank you. Well, you know, it was heartfelt because, like I said, I read it in one sitting. I know the girls really well. I know the sheriff really well. Not sure I like the sheriff's wife, but who knows? I'll ask you about her. So why don't you first tell the story about how you got yourself involuntarily into this whole mess in the first place?
Well, you know, this happens, I think, a lot to writers, where you're doing research on one thing and you turn up something else you weren't even looking for. So I was doing research for The Drunken Botanist, and I was writing about a gin smuggler named Henry Kaufman. And I just wanted to find out if Henry Kaufman had done anything else, you know, if it turns out that he was a senator. I might like to know about that before I put him in the book. So I went digging through the New York Times archives, and I turned up this other Henry Kaufman. I don't think it was the same guy. I never could really find out. But this guy owned a silk factory in Paterson, New Jersey, and he ran his automobile into this horse and buggy being driven by these three sisters. And the sisters just wanted payment for the damages, but that escalated into this crazy conflict, and pretty soon they were getting shots fired at their house, and kidnapping threats, and arson attempts. And it was really this kind of insane year in their lives. And the story fascinated me. Just one article, that was the beginning of it.
Well, am I wrong? And I've listened to your interviews and all. I can see it there, too. But am I wrong about this undercurrent of humor throughout the book?
No, you're not wrong about that at all. I think humor is such a tricky thing for writers. And I actually, when I teach writing classes, I talk about this a little bit. I think what happens for me is that sometimes I will crack myself up as I'm writing. You know, like I don't deliberately try to figure out how to drop a joke in, but something will occur to me that seems a little, not silly, but usually it's just kind of ironic or kind of over the top or kind of not what you're expected. It would be like, oh, well, it would be funny if she said the total opposite of what you were expecting right there.
Or like, you know, or like kind of Floretta and the Frogs, like that little sex, you know, you make
right.
one remark there. Yeah. It's funny because every once in a while you let it out overtly. Like you'll say, I only caught like 3 or 4 spots where you go, Norma gave a little half smile. Or the sheriff and Constance laugh at the same time, or Nora smiled, or I tried not to smile. But it's funny, it just comes out a little bit in real life, but underneath, especially like between Florence and Constance, they have this sarcastic kind of meanness to each other, which is really kind of like love instead.
Yeah, I think it's what happens with families. And, you know, sarcasm's hard to write because you don't get the tone or the facial expression to see that they're sarcastic. And so I always fight that, you know, like, well, I think I need, somebody has to show some kind of reaction here so the reader understands that this is sarcasm.
Yeah.
But I try to do as little of that as I can get away with.
That's why kids today, when they're texting, I read this study that kids can't recognize facial expressions anymore because they don't see people. But
wow.
Scary. Yeah. But when they text, you know, you can't just text without putting an exclamation point or an emoticon, emoji, whatever they are. If you don't put a smiley face, someone doesn't understand that mm-hmm. you're being, you know, you can't transfer that. But you've succeeded in doing it marvelously. Have you found in your talks that everybody gets it?
No, not everybody gets it, but I'm okay with that. I think that's what comedy's like. If, you know, any sort of comedy that appeals to everybody is too broad to be any good, probably. And, you know, this is actually something that I have been thinking about a lot since The Drunken Botanist came out. I wrote this book about booze, and there was a lot of sampling of cocktails that went on as I was writing the book. And I learned that people's taste in cocktails varies widely, and the reason is that we have taste receptors in our mouths that are very slightly different in shape between one person to the next. And some of the flavor molecules simply cannot get in and make a connection with your taste receptors, so you don't taste the delicious thing that other people are experiencing. And I just learned, like, I can't make a drink that pleases everybody. It's physically impossible to do. And so I feel that way about this. You know, I can't possibly write something that everyone is going to find equally funny. That doesn't happen. So I think there actually needs to be a certain percentage of people who don't get it.
It's funny, kind of along those lines, a lot of the people I've been interviewing lately write books in which everyone is kind of good. And here you write, like, this villain and his gang. There really isn't one redeeming quality to Mr. Kaufman, is there? I couldn't find one.
Right, yeah, no. In the book, he's based on a real person, but he happens to be one of the real people in the book that I know the least about. So in the book, he's kind of a spoiled son of a wealthy industrialist. He's a drunk. He likes to play cards and smoke cigars and run around in his fast car with his little gang of punk friends and spend his daddy's money. And he was kind of a bad seed right out of the gate. You know, he was the kid who was, you know, torturing puppies when he was, I mean, he was just a problem from the very beginning. So, no, he doesn't have much going for him. And he, you know, the whole thing is just about trying to put a stop to him, never trying to make him better or redeem him in any way.
It was a good technique because, you know, especially with Constance, it gave her something to, and I don't want to give too much away, but it gave her something to always push against, and she persevered throughout. None of them, except Florette maybe once or twice, ever really had any fear that they expressed to each other, maybe deep down in their thoughts in bed. When certain things happened, they did feel fear. But for the most part, they were quite plucky sisters.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up. I realized the other day that while I was writing this book, I was going through kind of a similar situation that I didn't at all connect with the book, but the house directly across the street from mine had turned into kind of a meth house, and these kids had moved in who were doing drug deals right in front of the house and getting into fights, and it was really kind of terrifying. But everyone in the neighborhood was so angry that we never really stopped long enough to be afraid of them. We mobilized, we had a plan. I trained a video camera on them and had a live feed that I was sharing with the police. And another woman who was, you know, kind of elderly and frail, but she was furious, and she would walk right up to the cars and take pictures of the license plates right in front of them. It was mostly women, and we had just had it, and we wanted them out of our neighborhood. And so now, looking back on that experience, I was never really afraid. There were a couple of times when I couldn't walk out my front door. Like, there was something happening right in front of the house, and I'd have to text my husband and say, I'm going to be late. I can't leave right now because there's a drug deal happening in front of us, and I don't want to step outside. But I was weirdly not afraid of them. I just wanted them gone. And I think now, looking back on it, I realize that may have colored how I wrote about these three women and their reaction to Henry Kaufman attacking them.
What was cool was, you know, people talk about women's place in society and breaking glass ceilings and lots of different feminist approaches to why women are, unfortunately, not treated equally with men. But you do it in a different kind of way. It's subtle, but it's really well done. Like when Kaufman kind of turns to the jury and says, she's just not like a regular woman.
And right.
The jurors just start laughing because what the heck is that supposed to mean?
Or
she's not a regular woman. Or if you want to fight, I'll bring you a man your size. And then when the sheriff, like, he'll look askance at Constance, but in a nice way, like going, huh, I've never really met a woman like this. Which bodes well for a sequel, which everyone seems to be saying.
Oh, yes. Believe me, there's a sequel. It's
cool.
On the way.
That's great.
Oh, yes.
Well,
more to come.
That brings me to a question, because in my mind, I have an idea of what's going on with Sheriff and Constance, which brings me to the sheriff's wife. And I can't figure out whether she's just fed up with this whole thing, living where she's living, have to deal with all this stuff, or whether she just doesn't like her husband. Couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, you know, she's a minor character in this book. We only see her, I think she's only in two or three scenes. And the thing about the sheriff's wife, her name is Cordelia Heath. She's a real person. These are all real people, and as much as possible, I stuck with their real stories. I don't know how Cordelia Heath really felt about being married to the sheriff of Bergen County, but I tried to put myself in her position. In those days, the sheriff lived at the prison. And I've been to that prison, and I've been inside the apartment where she and her husband and their children lived. And I don't think she would have liked living at the prison. It was not a pleasant place to be. So I imagine that she was unhappy about that. I imagine her as a woman who's not terribly sympathetic to her husband's progressive ideals about rehabilitating criminals. She's a little put off by all the sort of bold things he's trying at the prison that have really never been tried before. He opened himself up for a lot of criticism politically for wanting to give the inmates health care, education. He held church services at the jail, which no one had done, and wanted to look at the root causes of poverty and crime. So I just think, you know, sometimes being married to the progressive leader is not all it's cracked up to be.
I like Nora because it's like she feels the same way as the sheriff's wife, but it's just like she doesn't say anything about it, but she'll just look at him and kind of semi-shake her head or just look away. Her way of approaching it is completely different.
Yeah, Norma's the middle sister, and I know quite a bit about her from real life because I actually tracked down a family member who remembers her from when he was a young boy and she was an old woman. So I have a real sense of her as someone who's very distrustful of strangers, very blunt and forthright, says exactly what's on her mind, knows how to hold a grudge, you know, remembers things forever. And just sort of this like powerful, she's like a battleship moving through moving through life. She was in real life a very hard person to love, and she was hard on other people. So I believe that in real life she did not think much of Sheriff Heath, and so I'm drawing as much as I can from what kind of person she really was. She had more conservative politics when it came to the handling of criminals than he did, and I think she may not have welcomed his meddling in their lives and his friendship with Constance. It was a new thing for them to have a man hanging around doing anything at all. These are three women who were living in more or less seclusion on a farm in New Jersey and didn't have any kind of social life and were not used to having to deal with other people much, much less a man.
So Nora's feelings about the sheriff and his friendship with Constance, like in the sequel, so am I thinking, right?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean that kind of, sorry. I didn't mean the cat out of the bag at all, but that's just what I felt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll leave it be. So tell us about, because this goes along with Kaufman and his gang and the bricks through the window and things like that. Tell us about the Black Hand Society, what it was back then.
Yeah, I loved, you know, I loved the some of the historical elements that are in play in this book were so much fun for me to research. The Black Hand gang was at the time believed to be a gang of Sicilian mafia guys who sent very simple, crude extortion letters. It was generally, pay us $1,000 or we're going to blow up your house. Pay us $1,000 or we're going to kidnap your daughter. I mean, they were real straightforward and simple. People were terrified of them. There were stories about Black Hand threats in the papers almost every day. What we know now, looking back, is that these were mostly copycat crimes. There are these great letters that university libraries have in their archives of actual Black Hand letters, and they are written out in fake Italian accents. So it's like, bring the money to the, you know, like these, as if that's how Italian people actually talked. So looking back on it, it seems kind of absurd, but people were terrified at the time. And Enrique Caruso, for instance, was a victim of Black Hand letters and paid him for a long time until he figured out that once you start paying these guys, it never stops. And he finally had to go to the police. So when Constance and Norma and Florette first got a letter demanding $1,000, or they were going to kidnap Florette and sell her into white slavery, another odd product of its time, they took it very seriously, and they would have been thinking that they were dealing with real Sicilian mafia members. Although you get a sense, there's a little kind of hint to the modern reader, because at one point someone says, well, Kaufman doesn't sound like an Italian name, does it? And, you know, it's the 1914 is at the very beginning of the, we're starting to be a little suspicious about maybe these are all just copycat crimes and these are just run-of-the-mill thugs.
It's interesting about the threat of kidnapping Florette, and it has all kinds of implications with regard to Constance, for example. But you made her so beautiful, and it's almost like she should. And then I felt kind of sorry for her in a way, because she's always doing these wonderful things that are like off kilter, but so funny and so imaginative, and she's such a sneak in the way she, like my daughter, can hear everything. You know, All of a sudden, you know, you'll be talking for half an hour, all of a sudden she goes, I never said that, and you realize She's been listening to the whole thing. And it seems like she should be in town having this coming out party and being a debutante and all. I was thinking, you know, maybe Frances is right. Maybe they should come to town, you know?
Yeah. Florette is 16 in this story, and really was. I have photographs of her. You know, she was a beautiful young woman. She did in real life sew all her own clothes, and she was very fashionable, very petite. She's about 5'2" in heels, but you know, in real life, she really did turn heads and was very talented and had big ideas for herself. So they'd been kind of isolated and living off on their own probably for too long, and Florette is definitely chafing against that and wanting to get out in the world. But you have to remember, this is a time when, it was tough for women to kind of go anywhere and do anything. You know, we're at the very end of the Victorian era and not really in the modern era yet. And young women were still being arrested for waywardness and incorrigibility. A woman leaving home, a young woman especially, leaving home to go do something on her own could actually result in her being institutionalized. That is not an exaggeration. So it was very unusual for women to kind of make their way without the oversight of a man or a chaperone or something like that.
How did you, in your research, which is assiduous, as I said at the beginning, how in your research did you come across, like, Mr. Lamotte? And talk to us a little bit about who he was. Was there a profession like that? And, you know, it just popped out of nothing, but it became very interesting, and I almost wish there was a novel about what he did.
Yeah, I know. I love Mr. Lamotte. He's a photographer in New York City who takes photographs to be used as evidence in trials. And although he's a fictional character, there were people like him working for attorneys at the time. And we will see more of him and his side of the business in future books. You know, in terms of what was going on with the criminal justice system in the 1910s, it was just beginning to enter the modern age. Like everything else, it was, you know, we were getting the earliest little bits of technology overtaking kind of old Victorian ways. So being able to use photography as evidence in court cases was brand new, and that was a profession. I mean, not everybody had a camera, and you needed to know what to do and how to do it. It was also a time period where handwriting analysis was being used for the first time. And there's actually a guy who gets called in on the Henry Kaufman case to present handwriting analysis to the jury. And he's a real person. He really did work on that case, and he really was one of the pioneers of handwriting analysis, this guy William Kingsley. And even fingerprints, that was also brand new. So I love it that I love being able to see sort of the very beginnings of things that we take for granted and might think, you know, have been around forever.
Yeah, I know. I like that, too. I like doing that, thinking back to the way technology was and where we are now. Yeah. And how it was still useful. But going again back to Constance, and you could tell that, well, he's an interesting guy, interesting relationship between she and him. And then the scene where she already likes that room on the fifth floor. And when she and her escort, who is hilarious, go to the hotel, and she's on the sixth floor. She likes the room on the fifth floor. And she's good at what she does with that camera. She's really good. So if we are thinking of the future, I can see her being, you know, like doing that too, you know, really well.
Yeah, yeah. And much of that, you know, those are little hints of other things that I know about her that happen later. I mean, I have hundreds of newspaper articles and family stories and all kinds of things about what went on in their lives for many, many years, of which this is only the beginning. So the scene that you're talking about, Constance is asked to go to a hotel for women, which was another thing that, you know, we don't have anymore. But no other male investigator could get in, and they just needed a photograph out of a hotel room window to know what a suspect or a victim might have been able to see out of a window. And she could go up and do it because she was a woman, so she had to real quick learn how to operate a camera and go take pictures for Henri Lamotte because she owed him a favor. So, yeah, it's nice to sort of put her in a world and get to see her experiencing what professional life might be like for you know, she could maybe be a girl photographer. Maybe that's something.
Yeah, it's funny.
Kind of finding her way.
What was the name of the guy who escorted her to the hotel?
Oh, Mr. Hopper.
Can you describe him in your own words, what he looked
like?
Yeah.
So Mr. Hopper is just sort of, you know, he's an investigator who works with these photographers, and he's just going to accompany her over there to make sure that she gets to the right place and that nothing goes wrong and that no trouble is started. And he's just this mountain of a man. You know, Constance is very big. Constance is 6 feet tall and weighs 180 pounds, and that's also how she really was. And she was used to towering above most men, even, especially in those days. But Mr. Hopper is enormous, and he's got this kind of hat that comes down over his head and a big trench coat, and he doesn't really say much, and he's got this big growly Brooklyn accent. And so, you know, he's kind of fierce. I mean, he pretty much walked off the set of The Sopranos and
right into
this world.
Like Luca Brasi in The Godfather. But the thing about it is once again, you do it, it's like he is all these things, but he's kind of a nice guy, you know? You just say a couple of words, and then he becomes kind of a nice guy, right?
Yeah.
That's very hard to do.
And yeah, he's not menacing.
No, and he says he says like two things, but it's clear that there is a certain something that cares. It's interesting how you put that together. And the other thing is when Constance says to Mr. Lamont, what's this all about anyway? And tell our listeners, like, what is good advice in a criminal context, or, you know, what you're supposed to do and what you're supposed to know.
Exactly. So she wants to know why she was sent on this errand and what it was that was or was not seen out of the window. And he says, oh, no. The way you handle things like this is that you put up walls between your investigators and your photographers and your detectives and your victims, because if they don't know anything, then they can't tell anyone. So I am putting a wall between you and my and my case. And get on out of here. You've done what you needed to do, and go. So he really advises her to not go around telling too many things to too many people. And she's at that moment kind of in the middle of, you know, getting caught up in another criminal matter. So she takes that advice to heart and keeps a few things pretty close to her chest as a result.
And it's good philosophical advice for your life in a lot of ways. I mean, you know.
Boundaries.
Yes, which I've never really recognized, as you may be able to tell thus far. But another thing that you talk about that maybe people don't know about is how these orphanages work. And there's a portion of the story that deals with a purloined, kidnapped child, infant. And how did those orphanages work for people who were working for a company town and buying things at the store and going deeper and deeper in debt and being threatened, or even worse? Were there places like this for women who found themselves in that predicament?
Yeah. You know, what's so interesting about the world as it was 100 years ago is that it was not at all unusual for children who had parents or had a parent somewhere to nonetheless find themselves dropped off at an orphanage. It happened a lot when mothers died that their father would simply take them to an orphanage and say, well, if I can get back on my feet and maybe find myself another wife, I'll come back and get you. And maybe they came back for you, maybe they didn't. And a lot of us actually have these stories in our own lives. I got so good at doing genealogy as a result of working on the cop family for my novel that I've become a little amateur genealogist, and I like to do other people's families. And you go back 100 years and you find people who were just sort of put in an orphanage for a little while. I can think of three or four people who I've done their genealogy and we have found them in some institution like that. Kids kind of got handed off and passed around more than they do today.
Yeah. It's, you talk about it in your interviews, too. Ancestry.com really is an amazing resource. There's other ones, but Ancestry.com I found, you know, researching my grandfather coming over from Russia in 1904 and looking at the ship's manifest and the census from each of those years. It's fascinating.
And
you can't stop doing it. It's like some kind of video game thing, you know?
Oh, it's very addictive. I'm actually finding as I'm going around on book tour, if I mention it in front of audiences, I get these looks of recognition from a few people, and it's like this. It's like this glazed look, like we're recognizing fellow addicts in each other.
Well, now you can even send in your DNA. I mean, you can send in your blood, and they give you your DNA and tell you were, you know, second cousins with Queen Victoria.
Yeah, you don't even have to send your blood. It's just your spit.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I've done it. Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Are you related to Marie Antoinette or anything?
No, I don't think so.
Well, so when you, the good, you know, it's like when that James Fry wrote Million Little Pieces and he got in trouble because it was supposed to be true and it wasn't. The one thing you do carefully is you say, look, I'm not telling this story the way it happened. I'm putting together people, but no, this is not the truth the way it happened. It's a combination of characters, and there's some fictional aspects of it. And I think you do that very responsibly. Was that something you thought about?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, I loved, as the story actually happened, was so fascinating to me, and that is the story I wanted to tell. So really, although I've added fiction to fill in the gaps, the things that are true are all in there more or less how they happened, and all I've done is kind of embellish on top of it. And I hope to stay true to that as I continue to write about them. I really want the real things that happened to them are so interesting that they don't need to be thrown out and replaced with something else. And I put an afterword in the book explaining all of that. And you know, right. It's funny, at the time I wrote it, it seemed like a very natural thing to do because I've written 6 works of nonfiction, and you always sort of put something at the end to explain about your sources. It didn't occur to me until later that most people don't do that with historical fiction. But it seems like the most natural thing in the world because, of course, people want to know, you know, well, if you say it's true, what do you mean by true? Where is it true? So, yeah, it's all explained in there.
Yeah, I interviewed Eric Larson for, like, I think in the Garden of Beasts, and I may do it for Dead Wake. But I think I got him angry at me because I said, well, how do you know that she was having this affair? He goes, every single thing in there has a source. And
right.
And he was very upset with me for implying that perhaps he had added something, which would have been fine. I mean, I wouldn't have been upset about it. But he made sure, he made clear to me that every single thing in that book and in Dead Wake came from a source or more than one source.
Well, it's funny because, you know, we do expect even nonfiction writers, we take it for granted that probably there's a little bit of fiction in there. But have you ever read any of Paul Collins' books?
No.
Paul Collins is a wonderful writer, and he has lately been writing these sort of, you know, I guess I would say true crime in a very historical, you know, from a very historical perspective. And his last book, I'm trying to remember what it's called, but he, every line of dialogue is actually true. Murder of the Century is the one I'm thinking of.
Okay.
He wrote Murder of the Century, and he wrote Duel with the Devil, and they're both true stories, and all the dialogue in it is sourced and perfect, and his own wife said to him at one point, she read the manuscript, and she said, I think it would be helpful if you had a scene where he said this. And he looked at her and said, you do understand that this is all true. I mean, even his own wife couldn't get her head around the fact that none of it was fiction.
Yeah, it's, you know, I've interviewed these authors that say they wrote their book in 10 years or 6 years or whatever, and I'm thinking, to do what you've done, I mean, it has to be so hard. I mean, when I'm reading a novelist, the thing that, or when I'm writing, for example, it's like, I keep forgetting that I'm allowed to lie. You know, you can lie as much as you want. You can lie about everything. But when you're doing a book like yours, you really have put yourself in a position that you can't really lie. And that's difficult, extremely difficult.
Right, right, yeah. Or at the very least, I need to keep track of the lies.
Yeah, and
there's actually one thing in Girl Waits with Gun that I forgot was true. Florette going down to the creek to catch frogs to sell to a woman down the road who likes to eat frog legs. That's actually true. Florette really did that as a little girl. And at some point in the process, I forgot that her own son told me that story, and it wasn't until I was going back and listening to interviews with her son that I realized, oh, that's where I got that. That actually did happen.
And then it's nice the way, even after the old lady moves away, she still likes to go down and catch frogs. And then they actually have a meal. So it's like almost like, you know, part of your book, you still can't help yourself from talking about food, you know? It's like, because meals figure prominently in the book, you know, especially when they're running short of food. You know, they're not in the most best financial circumstances. And, you know, the gardening and all that. Yeah, you do bring in some of your other stuff, don't you?
Yeah, it is a little, it's a little joke in the book that Constance is in charge of the vegetable garden, which in those days was a very functional thing. It was just, we have to get some cabbages in the ground. But she hates it. She doesn't want to do it. It's a chore. So having written 6 books about plants and gardening in the natural world. That's just my little joke to myself.
Hey, what about Norma and her pigeons? Is that true?
No, it's not. I wanted a way to humanize Norma, and I thought about the women in my own life. Like, you know, maybe I think we all have that aunt in our family, maybe, who's sort of tough and disagreeable and hard to get along with, but she's always there. She comes to every family function. And I thought, you know, well, what humanizes a woman like that? And usually it's, you know, she's got this little dog or something. She doesn't like people, but she likes animals. So I knew I wanted to give her an animal, and I just thought, well, carrier pigeons would be so fascinating because they were actually still used to communicate. I mean, and it's not unreasonable for someone who's trying to kind of cling to the old ways and sort of be a little bit of a Luddite to say, you know, carrier pigeons are the only secure form of communication we have.
It's funny because why don't you tell about how Florence... You know, she constantly is inundating her sisters with these articles, you know, to kind of morally instruct them, and then what she does with the pigeons and the messages.
Right. Well, so having carrier pigeons means that you have to run them down the road and release them and let them fly back. I mean, that's kind of the whole point, and it's common for people to time them. There's something called a pigeon clock, and you have a pigeon clock that actually times the pigeons. So Norma was always taking the pigeons down the road and flying them home, but she didn't really have anything new to say because she'd only just left home, so she would cut out headlines from the newspapers and roll those up in the little tubes and attach them to their legs and send them home. So they're almost all real newspaper headlines of the day. I spent a lot of time reading 1914 newspapers, and she would send something home to Florette, for instance, that says, the morals of a woman are read in her gowns. So she's always sort of judging and chastising her sisters through newspaper headlines.
Yeah, so it's like someone sold into white slavery or a woman found dead. Some of them were kind of morbid, which is great.
Right, yeah.
And then what is it that Constance suggests that the birds could do? And Norma says, no, that's not the way they work. Like, what was it she suggested?
Right, well, the first time Sheriff Heath comes to the house, he's trying to be friendly with Norma, and he says, oh, my inmates.
Oh, yeah.
My inmates want to keep pigeons, but the higher-ups won't let me do it because they think that they could be used to send secret messages. And Norma gets very crabby about that and says, they only fly home. They aren't postmen. They don't deliver on a route. And she storms off, you know, basically says, well, he doesn't know the first thing about a carrier pigeon, which suggests an incurious mind. She's fed up.
And he's just trying to be nice, and he's just trying to find some, like you said, some common ground.
Right.
Because he's really, he's like the opposite of Kaufman. He's just a very nice person, and he works until he's, and you show in a couple of scenes, you know, he's so tired. And,
yeah.
And Constance kind of worries about that, which bodes towards the sequel. And, she's worried about the way he looks, the way he's acting, and wants to, she's upset that he's working so hard that he ends up, you know, feeling that way.
Yeah, you know, because I had such great newspaper access, I knew everything else that Sheriff Heath was doing while he was dealing with the cop sisters' problems. So I tried to always be mindful of that in the background, like, wow, you know, he shows up at their house on this night in November, and he's just been at a murder scene. And some of that stuff comes out. Some of it Constance knows about because she can read about it in the papers, but some of it doesn't come out. It's just that he does get beaten down. He's under a lot of political pressure, so he's always called to account for his actions with the Board of Freeholders, which is kind of like a county board of supervisors. And he's dealing with really tough, awful crimes and tragic situations. You know, it's often the sheriff who gets called out to do things like evictions and, you know, put people out of their house and stuff like that. So it had to have been a hard job.
Yeah. And of course he's got this constant, rebuffing of his suggestions, as you said earlier, by his superiors, and he's constantly got that to worry about as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see, we're at 40 minutes and 27 seconds. Let's stop here, and then I'll ask you one more question, we'll close out, and then I'll ask you that, we can take our time to think of that 30-second question, okay?
Okay.
Okay, here we'll go. So do you think in the future that you'll go back to the natural world? Or do you think you're so caught up now and so excited about what you've done that you're going to stick with the type of novel that this is? Or you think you're going to intersperse?
You know, at the moment, I'm completely caught up with The Cops, and I have a very clear sense of where it's going. This is one of those stories that takes several books to tell. You know, it's a big story that has a beginning and a middle and an end. And I would like to get all the way through it and see it come to a conclusion, but it will take several books to work through it. It's never going to be straight, like, crime fiction. I mean, it sort of has the look of that with the, you know, it's got this very kind of spiffy cover. She's got a gun in her hand, and it definitely sort of feels like that. And it is a series, but it's never going to be like a whodunit. You know, this is more the story of these women's lives as they move into the modern era and what happens to them as the result of that. So it's very hard for me to think about anything else right now.
It's a good cover. I mean...
It's a great cover. I love it.
Well, you know, we both own bookstores, so, you know, everyone can say to you, no, don't judge a book by its cover, but you and I both know that when people come into your bookstore, that's what they do.
Oh, I judge books by their covers all the time.
And it's just, you know, that's why publishers pick them. Unless, well, did they let you vet it, or did you get a chance to be in the process, or did...
Yeah, I put together an idea board with actual images from their real lives, the photographs I have of them, and some of the really fun newspaper illustrations of the events that they went through. And then I also put together some images of political posters of the day that I think show the kinds of typefaces and colors and art that was in use in 1914. And then also just book covers that I liked. And it turns out that one of the artists who made one of the book covers I liked is the one who was chosen to do this. And I think he did an amazing job.
Yeah, and it is a good font, too. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you today. And now I'm all excited because hopefully, if you wouldn't mind, if you're still willing to talk to me, the next book out, and as they come out, we can talk again.
I would love that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Amy Stewart talking about her new book, Girl Waits with a Gun, which is a total departure for her. All her other books about botany. This book will be on her book club. The botany books, like I said, they're hilarious. They're fascinating. The last one, The Drunken Botanist, is about, you know, if you go to New York now and you go to these bars, they all have, you can't just order a Tom Collins or something. They all have their own home-crafted drinks. And whether they're using elderberries or... I don't even know if they're using cinnamon or whatever they're using. It's a new way of making a drink, and that's what the book is about. And that's why they did it Gardeners, where they make a special drink using the botanicals that she talks about in her book. So that was really good. I really enjoyed talking to her. We have some good ones coming up that Rebecca's gotten for us. One is called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory, which sounds kind of morbid, but it's one of the funniest books I've ever read. Caitlin Doughty wrote it, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. And then we're going to, the Orange Prize nominee, Lauren Groff, is going to discuss her latest novel, Fates and Furies, which I'm actually working on to get. It'll be later this month. We just haven't come up with a date yet. So for a complete schedule, as always, just go to our website or go to Facebook. And like I said, it's easy now. Just type in Wellington Square Bookshop, and Google has been nice enough to pretty much put all our stuff there on the top, and at least on the first page. So thank you so much for joining us today. Go out, hopefully at our bookstore, and get Girl Waits with Gun by Amy Stewart. It's a very quick read, not in the sense of being elementary, but it's a very quick read in terms of drawing you in immediately and keeping you waiting to see what happens on the next page. Thanks again for joining us here on The Avid Reader.